You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is the monthly podcast to complement the online magazine Electric Sheep, which focuses on the best modern and classic world and cult cinema and related entertainment. In this podcast, I'm talking to a pair of female directors who have made films about loss and trafficking of humanity. Later in the podcast, I'm talking to Sophie Barth, the director of Cold Souls, a gentle sci-fi comedy in which Paul Giamatti plays a fictionalized version of himself who, confronted with his inability to act unemotionally in a production of Uncle Vanya, goes to a company that removes or exchanges human souls to allow the donor to cope with overwhelming or unwanted feelings. Paul is first perturbed by the physical manifestation of his soul when it's removed, and then keenly feels its absence when it is stolen by the wife of a Russian oligarch. Before that, I'm talking to the director of a documentary which deals with the far more serious subject of actual people trafficking. Miriam van Veelen is the director of the film Megumi, which by mixing contemporary interview footage and ambiguous recreations, tells the true story of Megumi Yokota, a 13-year-old Japanese girl who was abducted from near her home in November 1977. It subsequently turned out that she was one of a number of Japanese children who were kidnapped by North Korea to supposedly become trained as sleeper agents to spy on their home country. And to this day, her parents are still trying to find the truth about what happened and even answer the question of whether Megumi is still alive or not.
I was wondering what the inspiration was for first making this film. How did you come across the story of the kidnapped girl?
Actually, I read a quite big article in the Dutch newspaper in the end of 2002. That was exactly on the day when the North Korean leader finally confessed that North Korea had been kidnapping 13 Japanese people, and Megumi was one of them, the youngest. So I cut the article out, and there was a photograph along with the article published. And I thought it might be a very good subject for a documentary film, and it ended up to be one.
I mean, I suppose in Britain and in the West in general, we're used to the idea of the Cold War that took place between Russia and Western Europe and America, and all the sorts of kidnappings and spying that went on there. But until I came across this story, I had no idea that a similar thing was happening between Japan and Korea. I mean, was it the sort of familiarity and yet also the exotic nature of the story that appealed to you?
Not the exotic side, I think. I think the special thing about this Cold War, or how you want to call it, is that, of course, there is a very strange and very bad connection, diplomatic connection, between Japan and Korea, because Japan ruled over Korea for 35 years until the Second World War. It might be one of the reasons why North Korea kidnapped Japanese people. But actually the main reason was after Korea was split up into two parts, the North and the South, North Korea wanted to have South Korea, but under their conditions and rules, which are strictly communist. And they couldn't cross the border. So what they did actually was kidnap Japanese people, use their passports, use the language of the Japanese people. They were teaching North Korean spies. So the spies could go from North Korea to Japan and from Japan to South Korea and then try to infiltrate.
Because, I mean, as a Brit, a story that sort of has a similar resonance maybe with the British, because we had military bases in Cyprus, was that North Cyprus invaded half of the land that was owned by the South Cypriots. And again, during that occupation, people went missing, and to this day, it still has a very strong resonance with the people, even though decades have passed, because they don't know what happened to the missing people. Yeah. You know, it almost seems that there is a very long time limit before these stories can be forgotten, because we aren't given an answer.
They cannot be forgotten. And that's also what you see in the film, especially for the parents of Megumi Yokota. They're still fighting to get their daughter back. And don't forget that North Korea, of course, it's what is special about this story is that North Korea is one of the last closed countries. So it's so difficult to get the information or to go there. I mean, it's impossible.
Your approach to making the film, I wonder if that was informed by the fact that the parents still seem to be in denial. They're given evidence, mm-hmm. you know, that their daughter died and had a child, and these are the ashes, and mm-hmm. this is a photo of her, and yet they don't want to believe that this is the truth. They want to believe that somehow she'll still come back to them. And so your mixture of sort of fact and fiction mm-hmm. in the film, I was wondering if that was informed by their sort of sense of not being able to accept the truth.
Yeah, it's I'm not sure what the truth is, but it was very important for me to show that for the parents, and not only for the parents, but actually for a big community in Japan, Megumi is still alive because there is no proof of her death. There is proof that she has been kidnapped because she had a daughter, and they did DNA tests on the daughter and Megumi's mother, which was compatible. So Megumi really is in North Korea. But about her death, it's not sure. I mean, there is no proof, actually. I mean, everybody can write a paper, yes, well, that somebody died. Yeah. That's bullshit. And then when the ashes came, people thought maybe this is a proof, but there were traces of three or four other people and not Megumi, so no proof again. So there is something with Megumi, which wasn't really other people that had been kidnapped, so there's no answer. And if there's no proof of somebody being dead, then he's alive. Yeah. And that's, I definitely wanted to show that,
Because you have interviews with the parents, you have interviews with her teacher, and then you have reconstruction in the sense that there's an actress playing Megumi and there's an actress playing you as well, filming her. What sort of informed that idea of having that kind of recreation, but not going further and saying having, you know, historical recreation for the events?
Because I liked it better to do it in an associative way, because it's all about feeling. It's very strange. I mean, somebody is there and then somebody isn't there. North Korea says she's dead and Japan says she's alive. So I didn't want to make, I mean, they do it very well at National Geographic, to make a historical reconstruction, but it wasn't my interest. I think it's, for me, the biggest interest was that the parents still believe that she's alive, but she never got older. I mean, for them, she's still 13 years old, because they haven't seen the last 30 years.
And I suppose equally, even though they've been shown a photo of her, it may not even be a photo of her, you know.
Well, the first photograph they got from North Korea, that was really a strange one. It was copied and pasted a lot. So the only thing which was probably hers was her face. And then she had different hair, maybe because she was wearing a cap. She had two right arms. It was just copied and pasted, because probably it was the only photograph they could find, and she was arm in arm with maybe her husband, and they didn't want to show that person. So they very, in a very stupid way, actually, they copied and pasted it. So they really didn't know if that was her. But then later on, they came, they received photographs, and I guess you can see, and they say it also in the film, the parents see it. It's their daughter. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Some of the more associative footage that you have in the film of landscapes seems to be talking about the nature of absence, the fact that these are empty landscapes, and accompanied by very evocative music as well. I guess it's making the audience contemplate the nature of loss and how it must be for these parents who can't move on and are just faced with emptiness.
Yeah, thank you. Well, if you felt it like that, it's that's good. That's also part what I wanted. So it's loss and it's hope.
Because you come from an art background, so I suppose you're used to narrative also being suggested by a single image and what we read into that.
Yeah, sure. I come from visual art. So that's, I think my films are quite imaginative, and I'm not that much interested in only the facts.
Well, particularly when the facts can't be established.
Also, but So I thought reconstruction is not worthful for me, not for me as a filmmaker. And I also wanted to make it as a personal document, because I really got very much involved in the story and into the family. So I thought, even if it's a documentary, there may be a personal signature. I love to watch them myself, and I like to make them too.
As a documentarian in Holland, what kind of outlet is there for the kind of films you make? Because this is 63 minutes, which isn't quite long enough to be a feature film, but it's almost too long for television. So it's a sort of halfway house.
Yeah, I made a short version. So there is a version for television, but nobody, hasn't been on television yet. So it particularly went to a lot of festivals. I think almost 15 festivals. The only country that hasn't taken it yet is Japan, which is really, really a pity. Yeah. But it has been traveling around to Europe and even America. Yeah, that was really good.
Well, I'm surprised that it hasn't found an audience in Japan, because if you Google Megumi, there's an animated version of her story that you can download for free. So it's obviously something they want to keep prescient, you know, in the public's mind.
Yeah, that's one. I think that was released last year, and then before, I think I was the first foreign filmmaker actually to meet the parents in 2003, I think it was. And then it took me quite a long time to get it financed. And meanwhile, there have been two American-Korean filmmakers who made a movie about the abduction issue. Not about Megumi specifically, but about all the people that have been kidnapped, the 13 ones. So still, I wanted to make the way I got a chance, so I'm really happy with it. But it may be one of the reasons why they're a little bit full of, or how you say it,
In terms of Megumi representing the whole kidnap issue, is she the most famous example?
Yes.
She sort of became the poster child unwittingly.
Yeah. She really, everybody knows Megumi Yokota, and she's an example for something that never should have happened, actually.
Because
it's also strange, because actually when she didn't come home one day from school, and the parents really didn't have a clue where she disappeared to. And of course they were searching the first years, but no answer, nothing. So, and then the first 20 years, they were living in an emotional gap, not knowing if she's alive or dead or where she is. And then after 20 years, it popped up that she may be in North Korea. And from then on, their personal grief started to be from the whole country, actually.
I was wondering, what's the reaction being like to audiences in this country? Because you're doing a Q&A tonight, for example, and it's been shown at a couple of other festivals. Because obviously whatever country you show the film in, it has different cultural resonances. And certainly in this country, it's very difficult to watch Megumi and not think of our most famous recent kidnapping case, which was Madeleine McGann. And again, it's a story where people who read about it in the media don't know what happened, you know, even whether the parents are telling the truth.
Well, reactions. I think in general people like the film. Some people have some difficulties with the fiction parts, and those who like it, they really love the film, especially because of that. And I think it's a very intimate portrait of the parents. I still feel sad myself. I mean, I have seen the film quite a lot of times, and being with the parents a lot of times. But if you see them portrait in double portraits or single portraits, you see the pain on their faces and the love for their lost girl. And people, a lot of people experience that too. Every parent, I mean, can imagine that it's the worst thing that can happen.
Absolutely.
To your child,
And within your work, your own work as a whole, how would you see how this film fits in? Because I was reading about your previous film, The River Okkervil, which mixes animation and other genres. Does the subject matter of each film that you're making suggest a different approach to it, and you just tackle each one as it comes along? Or do you have different ways of filmmaking that you're sort of exploring with each project, and it's only when you sort of come to the editing process you know exactly the kind of film that you're making?
No, not at all. For the Megumi film, I definitely knew very well what I had to film to end up with this, as it was for the River Okkervil, which is my first film, actually, so it's quite a long time ago. But I think in general, a theme that's coming back all the time is the many layers we have in reality. You can interpret it in so many different times, so that's actually what I want to show. There's not one reality. There are many of them. And sometimes it's, I use different genres to show it. And The funny thing is sometimes is that the artificial genres like animation or the fiction scenes here in this Megumi film, they become more real than the real than the real people or the real real story in a way. So yeah, but that's
Because I guess if there is an absence at the heart of a story like Megumi in this one, there needs to be some kind of representation to the audience. And so it's sort of comforting in a way to see an actress play her if there's no other footage available.
Maybe in a way, yes. And this might be different for a Japanese audience, but I think everybody understands. That's also one of the reasons why it's not a reconstruction. It's not a it's not historical facts. It's love. It's atmosphere. It's feeling. It's not Megumi, and everybody knows that very well. Yeah. So I think, not afraid of it, but yeah. It's what everybody's feeling, yes, because everybody's saying she is still alive. So I think it's not. There's nothing against. Trying to imaginize this feeling.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting watching your film now because there is a recent British film that came out in this country called Helen, which is an entirely fictional film. But I think, again, it's informed by, say, the Madeleine McGann story and events like Megumi's. And it's about a girl who is asked to take the part of a missing girl in a police reconstruction. And then she finds herself sort of becoming part of the missing girl's life in the way that whenever this sort of event is reported in society, everyone sort of finds their own association with it and almost becomes part of their extended family, which I think is a very interesting issue. In terms of the films that you make, what sort of subjects would you say interest you? I mean, because they seem to be quite a very disparate.
It's
your approach that makes them, you know.
Yeah, about hope and love, yeah. But maybe I try to find beauty in tragic stories. I mean, yeah, we need drama, yes. I mean, this is life. We have it in personal lives and we have it in film, we have it in literature. I'm not making comics. Because if you experience feelings like loss or hope or things like that, I mean, there's coming something new. There's existing something, which I think is really nice to show.
And is that why films that are perhaps categorized as documentary have a greater association for you than making films that are purely fiction? Because as with making art, it has to reflect the real world, and the more that you fictionalize the real world, the more you take the risk of alienating the audience.
Well, for me, it's a bit difficult. For me, actually, I always say I'm a filmmaker because I don't care if it's fiction made out of real or if it's real and going into fiction. Yes, I think reality is, but I make fiction too. So, yeah. but I think I stick to the real real stories because there is fiction in it too.
Cool. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay.
For more info about Miriam van Veelen's film Megumi, please visit her website www.miriamvanveelen.com. That's www.miriamvanveelen.com. To watch an animated version of Megumi's story, please visit www.rachi.go.jp/jp/Megumi. That's www.rachi.go.jp/jp/Megumi. Next, here's my interview with Sophie Barth, the director of the surrealist comedy Cold Souls, which tells the unlikely but strangely conceivable story of an international trade in human souls for people who can't cope with or want a holiday from their normal personality and emotions. Unfortunately, the phone line between London and New York was quite bad, so you'll have to forgive the quality of the recording of Sophie's answers to my questions. Cold Souls, it's your directorial debut. It seems a very confident first film. I was wondering what your background in film was before directing this feature.
I've made two shorts and a documentary, two documentaries, and I was at Columbia University. I didn't really do the entire film school program, but I took a lot of classes at the film school. The man with experience is Andrei Parekh, who's the cinematographer, and he's my partner in life. He shot maybe 12 or 13 features. He has a lot of experience and we always work together on the short.
I mean, I thought it was a great first film. In order to try and, I don't know, describe the genre that it belongs to, would you mind if I called it Kaufman-esque? Because it seemed to very much remind me of Charlie Kaufman's films.
No problem. There's been a lot of references to Kaufman.
The idea of a world where people can sell their souls and swap them with other people and live without them, it's a very interesting idea, and I was wondering if any of it comes from classical literature like Dante, or if it's a very modern idea, because we live such busy modern lives that we're so used to taking pills such as Prozac to change our emotions that almost using a machine to wipe our own soul seems a logical extension of what we're doing to ourselves anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the idea, was that it's the next step after Prozac, you know, that if the technology was available, I think a lot of people in New York would just run and get their soul extracted. But, you know, originally, I don't know if you've read the press release, but the idea came from a dream that I had.
Okay.
So it was 3 years ago, I was just finishing a book by Carl Jung, called Modern Man in Search of a Soul. and 2 days before that, I had just seen Woody Allen's Sleeper. And I think there is a weird connection happened in my brain, because I had this very funny dream that I was in a futuristic office holding a box. And Woody Allen was just in front of me. He was also holding a white box. And we were just waiting in line to see a doctor. And the doctor came and he said that our souls had been extracted. They will, you know, look at our souls and assess our psychological problems. So when Woody Allen's turn came and he opened his box, his soul was a little chickpea. So, you know, in the dream he gets very neurotic and he says there is no way. Like, so I didn't see the shape of my soul. But when I woke up, I thought this could be a really funny short film. And then I decided to just write it. But I think it's very inspired by, you know, Carl Jung, and he says exactly what you just say, that the drama of modern man is that we are neglecting our souls. This is the core of his work, psychoanalysis.
Mm. You could say that a lot of directors' work is almost them lying on a psychiatrist's couch and sort of projecting their fears and insecurities to the general public. I mean, does it worry you as a creator that perhaps in making a film like this you're bearing your own fears and insecurities to the public as a form of entertainment?
Oh, of course. I mean, yeah. I mean, if you don't do it, then, you know, it's a therapy. And I think, you know, in the character of Paul, I'm hiding a lot of my fears, a lot of the vulnerability of Paul as an actor, my own vulnerabilities. But it's easier when you choose a male character who's 45 and you're a young woman, so no one would know that you're hiding your own problems or fears or neuroses, you know. But I think when you write, all the characters have a little bit of your...
I was wondering if it's also somewhat a New York experience, because I went to film school there myself for 5 months, and it's such a strange and hectic city that you encounter so many different personalities and so many different ways of life there, that in order to kind of process that information overload, you have to construct metaphysical ideas in a way, you know, that the only way you can make sense of the way of people's actions is perhaps soul extraction or other kind of bizarre sort of answers to the questions of life.
Yeah. I think, you know, to a large extent, the U.S. is a country that is, for Europeans, when you come and live in the U.S., it's overwhelming sometimes. There is something in the climate that made me write. The tone is very much the way I was feeling at the time.
The casting of Paul Giamatti obviously is critical to the movie. Had you hoped that it would be him right from the start? Did you write the script expecting that you'd be able to get him? Or, in a way, did the casting come first and then you changed the script according to the actor that you knew you were able to get?
Well, originally for a few weeks I kind of played with the idea to try to cast Woody Allen, and then, you know, I thought it wasn't really realistic. Just at that moment I saw American Splendor. I really liked Paul Giamatti, and then I decided to write it for him. I won an award at the Nantucket Film Festival. They flew me there. Paul Giamatti was there. He was so, you know, the coincidence was so strange. And I told him I wrote this. He liked very much the idea of the dream, because he used to write his dream. He co-produced it. So it came out very organically, you know, very easily, but I don't think this is going to happen again. So I was lucky, I guess.
Well, it seems very much that you're an actor's director, to coin a phrase, because the kind of story that you're approaching could be treated in a very science fiction way and be very reliant on special effects. But actually, it's a film where you're letting the actors breathe and explore the personalities that they're having to inhabit in a very sort of American independent way that perhaps is unexpected for the subject matter.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. You know, it's science fiction with special effects was out of the way because we didn't have the budget.
Mm.
But I like science fiction that is part of the daily life, you know. And I think there is a movie that I really love from Jean-Luc Godard called Alphaville. But it was this idea to make that movie, they shoot Paris. So I very, very much like that. You know, I love also big science fiction movies like Blade Runner.
Well, it's interesting because America is obviously a country of immigrants, and yet still when international visitors come to America and do artistic projects based on their experiences of arriving in the country, it often has almost a science fiction quality to it because there is that dislocation of self and location that can be a very alien experience to someone who's arriving there for the first time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've been here almost 10 years. I mean, you integrate in a strange way in New York because everyone came from somewhere else. So it's eclectic.
Well, having lived in New York for 10 years, could you see yourself going back to Paris and finding that different and strange?
No, each time I go back, I find, you know, that it doesn't really change that much. It's strange to go back to your own country because it's very critical. I love going back to France, but I don't think I'll be able to leave there. Also, I didn't grow up in France, I grew up in South America.
A lot of the film is very funny. You spoke about Woody Allen's Sleeper as one of the films that inspired you. And I think it's interesting, the crossover between comedy and science fiction, because a lot of comedy is based on observing the world and then representing it in a slightly different way, which makes it humorous, while science fiction is about looking at the world and representing it in a slightly different way, which makes it strange and alien. And I think there hasn't been enough research in the crossover potential between the two genres.
Yeah, it's true. I didn't think about it. I think it's more maybe absurdism, you know, surrealism and absurdism. A lot of humor. If you see a Samuel Beckett play, they're very humorous in a way. There's a stronger tradition in theater. Someone maybe in film, someone like Buñuel, was not the mainstream comedy, but it's for me the.
And what project are you working on next? Because it seems quite a bold film to make as your debut, and in a way that raises the expectations of everyone who are wondering what your second film is going to be.
I hope I'm going to be able to make a second film because the situation right now for independent film is so difficult. But, I'm working on two things. I just had a baby 5 months ago, so I've been a little bit out of it for for those months. But now I'm writing, one that is also a very surreal science fiction piece based on the idea of the artificial uterus, you know, that you could cook babies outside of women's body, a little bit like Brave New World, you know. But the tone will be a comedy also. And the other one is an adaptation from a book that is not easy right now in the U.S. I don't know in Europe, but it's all about determination.
Well, I thought Cold Souls was great, so I really hope that you get funding for your next project.
Well, I hope so. Crossing fingers.
Cool.
Thank you so much.
Cold Souls is also the subject of the March comic strip review in Electric Sheep magazine, which is by Philip Spence, the creator of the webcomic The Adventures of Ninja Bunny. And you can find his review at www.electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/reviews. Cold Souls has just been released on DVD in the UK by Universal Pictures and is well worth a watch. If you enjoyed my interviews with Miriam and Sophie, there are a couple of other podcasts with filmmakers that complement this recording. In May 2009, I interviewed Christine Malloy, one half of the filmmaking duo Desperate Optimists, about their film Helen, which tells the tale of a girl who takes part in the reconstruction of the vanishing of another girl and how their lives intertwine. You can find that podcast at www.electricsheepmagazine.co.uk /events/2009. Also in that month's Reality Check, my podcast for the Science Fiction Film Festival, I interviewed Charlie Kaufman, one of the influencers on Sophie Barth's work, about his most recent film, Synecdoche, New York, and his cinema of gentle surrealism. You can find that at www.sci-fi-london.com/audio. Thanks for listening.